Hello and welcome to A Gay Old Time. My name is Nigel May. You may know me from things I've presented on the TV. You may know me as a host for my radio shows, or you may have read one of my novels. You may not know me at all, and that's just fine. But anyone who does know me will know that I am very proud to be a gay man and hugely proud to be part of a beautiful queer community. This podcast is a celebration of that community, of its many beautiful people, people of all ages, people who have fought with their emotions and who have faced struggles and emerged victorious, who have had to tread their own path in life to live their real truth. People who inspire, who aspire, and who always entertain. People who matter. Each episode, I'll speak to a person from our LGBTQIA+ rainbow, discuss their journey and their thoughts in our rich and varied queer community. One person, one life, one conversation, and I can guarantee a gay old time. My guest today is iconic pop star Hazel Dean. Hazel has been lighting up dance floors as the queen of high energy since her queer anthem Searching, I Gotta Find a Man became a massive smash back in 1984. Her back catalogue of other incredible tunes includes Who's Leaving Who, Maybe We Should Call It a Day, and Whatever I Do. Her music has been the soundtrack to many a queer person's life, including my own. I can't even begin to count the number of hours I've spent dancing to a Hazel Dean tune in an LGBTQ nightclub. Hazel is a gay woman and a huge trans ally and a supporter of trans rights. She is patron of Pride in Surrey and is featured on the Pride Power List as one of the most influential LGBTQ people in the UK. She recently celebrated 40 years of Searching with the release of fabulous new remixes. Hazel, welcome to A Gay Old Time.
Hello!
Hazel, it is such a pleasure to have you here on the podcast. I'm not going to lie, major fan. It feels like you and your music and your beautiful presence has been in my queer existence for the longest time. But I want to go right back to before even I had heard of the fabulous Hazel Dean. Let's go back to your childhood straight away. What kind of child were you, Hazel?
Well, according to my mother, I was a lovely child. I was a good girl. I never caused her problems like my brother and sister. So, yeah, I mean, that's what I was like as a child. If my earliest memories I did have a crush on my art teacher. I think lots of girls had crushes on teachers, really. So, I was a tomboy, which, you know, my mother, I always remember one Christmas, my mum, they bought me a pram. A doll's pram, which I immediately turned over and made out one of the wheels was a. I always wanted to drive. I was fascinated by cars and driving, so I turned it over, much to my mother's disgust, and made out it was a car. So that didn't go down very well. And I was a tomboy. I didn't want to wear dresses and things. I wanted to run around in the shorts and all that kind of stuff. Whether that means, I think lots of girls wanted to do that, to be honest. So, but yeah, I was a good kid. I was happy. I had a really nice family life. So
I've got to say, it wasn't just the girls that had crushes on the teachers as well. The boys did too. I am going to say that straight away.
Of course you did.
Were you a good pupil at school then, Hazel? I mean, you said obviously you had a crush on your art teacher, but I mean, were you a good student? Did you find studying and going to school, you know, a nice thing to do? Did you enjoy it?
No, not really. I'm severely dyslexic. So when I went to school, I mean, it wasn't really recognised back in those days because I went to school through the 60s. I mean, do you know the best school I think I went to was my infant school, which was a church school. And I remember those days with fond memories, nice teachers. But my junior school and my secondary modern that I went to, I hated school, to be honest. I was embarrassed by a teacher once over my spelling and he embarrassed me in front of the whole class. So it was things like that. But no, I didn't enjoy school whatsoever, really. I don't think I was a bad person at school. And I mean, towards the end of secondary modern, we had a fantastic, the one good thing at that school was we had a fantastic music teacher called Mrs. Eskews. And she started having guitar lessons in her class after school. And I joined that because right up, I mean, I was always into pop music and I loved it all. I loved the Beatles. I loved Tamla Motown, Dusty, all those kind of people. And so I was very keen to learn to play the guitar. And it started out with so many sort of kids in this, it wanted to learn to play the guitar, but over a few weeks it sort of whittled down and it ended up just a few of us. But I did learn to play the guitar. And so that kind of, you know, opened my whole world up at school, because it made me, because it was something I could do that was kind of other people, not a lot of other people could do. So, and I joined the school band. So, you know, those were my very early days of music. Always loved pop music. I was fascinated by it. So, you know, they're my early days. But after that, you know, there were some, and I remember, funny enough, this teacher actually got in contact with me a couple of years ago. He had a very odd name called Mr. Blood. But I remember him so well. He was an English teacher. And you know what? I mean, I was sort of up to, I think I was in the third or fourth year by the time he turned up. But he really helped me and he was very kind to me. And he contacted me, as I say, a couple of years ago and said, I do remember you, Hazel. And it was so nice. And I remember him. But apart from that, it was, yeah, no, Mike's the actual school itself. In fact, after 2 years after I left, the school was shut down and they put all brand new teachers. Yeah, there was a lot of bad things about that school. So, yeah, they're my school days.
So you were glad to see the back of that. You talked about your obviously want to learn music and want to sing and be musical. It sounds like you had aspirations at an early age. Those aspirations, I mean, were they something that you dreamed of in your bedroom? Did you do that classic singing along in front of the mirror? I mean, who were the posters on your walls? Who were your idols at that point, Hazel?
Posters on my wall. It would have been the Beatles, definitely. I love the Beatles. They're just, I mean, I particularly like Paul McCartney, not just because he was good looking, but I love, you know, he was my favourite writer as well. I loved Dusty, Cilla, I'm a big fan of Cilla Black, you know, loads, all those pop groups. I just loved them. I loved all that. Ready, Steady, Go, all that kind of stuff from the 60s. Yeah, so.
Did you find your love of music? I mean, when I was a child, Hazel, I remember like my bedroom was my kind of sanctuary. I used to lock myself away. I was obsessed with the charts. I was obsessed with, you know, posters on my walls, whoever it may be at that point. I was obsessed with TV shows. What were your obsessions? And did you escape to your bedroom to sort of get away from things like school? Were you that solitary child that searched for your own little world almost?
I wouldn't say I was a solitary child because I had lots of friends. But, yeah, when I used to get home, I would just go straight up to my bedroom and put on the records and play all these songs. And, yeah, I did. I did escape to my bedroom and I would practice, you know, singing, you know, with the hairbrush, all that. The guitar would be a tennis racket. I had all that stuff.
Fabulous.
One minute I was Dusty or Cilla, the next minute I was one of the Beatles. That's how it was with me.
So obviously we know that you went on to be this fantastic singer and, you know, the huge, huge career. It's like at that point, was that your aspiration to be a singer? Was that like the number one goal? Or were there other things that you thought, well, I wouldn't mind being that when I grow up? What was going through your mind at that stage?
No, it was definitely that's what I wanted to do. Back in those days when I was a teenager, I was in a local band. So I was out gigging every weekend with a band. And I always wanted to do it. I started having singing lessons when I was 16. And I was very lucky because the guys in the band, you know, that they were very keen for me to pursue my career. And they helped me find this school of singing. I've never wanted to do anything. I think being dyslexic, you know, has a lot to do with it. I get this from other people because you find something that you can do that other people can't do. And that, you know, you just go for it. And then, of course, when I discovered, because when I originally joined the band, I just used to play guitar. But then I started to think, well, what about singing? So I started singing, had a singing voice. And, you know, one of the songs I most remember singing back in the 60s was Lulu, the boat that I row won't cross no ocean. The boat that
My life is made now. I've had Hazel Dean sing to me on a podcast. How fabulous is that?
I'm going to see Lulu, you know, at the Palladium, because it's her last tour.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, another icon, as are you. So you obviously this joy to sing, and you signed to Decca Records in the late 70s. So what age were you when you signed?
Well, when I signed to, I'd have been in my early 20s, I think. Or was it a bit later? No, I can't remember. So long ago. I would have definitely been in my 20s. I met up with a guy called Paul Curtis, In fact, we lived together for a couple of years. We were partners. But he was really into my voice. I was in a band with him called Union Express back in the early 70s. And he was the first person that I worked with in a studio and recorded my voice. So when I heard my voice be recorded, you know, I was like, it's a weird feeling, but I thought, oh, God, it sounded fabulous. You know, I loved it. And we used to do lots of, I used to do all the demos and do all the backing vocals, all that kind of stuff. I learned a lot from those days. So they were my early days. But so it would have been because I did Song for Europe in 1976 at the Albert Hall, which was fantastic because in those days it was a big live, huge orchestra. And it was a big ballad, which is what I wanted to, because I aspired to Dusty and all those singers, Cilla, big ballads. So they're my early days, and I did sign to Decca Records, and I recorded an awful lot of tracks with Decca. But I think at that point in time, Decca were starting to, they'd been huge and very successful, excuse me, in the 60s, maybe early 70s, but they were, I think I caught them on the back end of those glory days, if you like. But having said that, I mean, you know, it was fantastic because we were working with, in the first session I ever did with live orchestras, you know, strings, and I love strings. So, yeah, I did have a deal with Decca Records.
I mean, that's incredible because there you were, I mean, you say early 20s. I mean, here we are, you know, in a day and age where, you know, taking part in things like Song for Europe, I know these days it's slightly different with Eurovision, and, you know, getting a record deal are things that people dream of. I mean, you were living that dream. Did it come easy or was it a lot of hard work to actually, you know, search out that record deal? Was it night after night of performing to get where you managed to actually sign the record deal?
Yeah, I've always performed live ever since I was a teenager. So that was part of my psyche. I was in those days in the 70s, I was singing with lots of different bands in and around London. So I used to work in loads of different big bands. I did sing at the in the 70s through the, yeah, that was mid 70s. I used to work with a band called the Andy Ross Band. And so you're looking at an 18 piece band in a Mecca ballroom, which, you know, in those days there was so much live work around. So that's the kind of stuff I was doing at that point in time. So I was out working sort of probably most nights of the week.
Something like that, I imagine, gives you a huge amount of confidence as well, as a performer, as somebody, you know, forging a beautiful path within their chosen profession. But how were you sort of like personally? I mean, did you have confidence in yourself at that point? Or was it, you know, when you go on stage to perform, you become, you know, Hazel on stage? But how was Hazel off stage? Was she confident too?
I wanted to be successful. So I had what I always say is a bit of a tunnel vision, really. And I loved it, you know. I mean, in the 70s, I started to write songs as well. So I had my guitar and I had a piano in my flat at the time. And so I'd sort of do all that kind of stuff in the daytime. Not every day, of course, but I would do that. And then I'd be out working in a band in the evening. And that was my life, you know. And then, as I say, I met Paul Curtis. I met Paul Curtis through working in a band with him. And then we parted company. But he came and sort of, I think it was the Lyceum, and he just happened to be there one night, came in and said hello, and he was working in studios, and that's how we got into doing the demos and then going on to the Decca Record deal, which obviously he was a big part of then because he was writing the songs. He was a good, I don't know if he still writes now, but he was a great songwriter at the time.
Can I ask you about the Song for Europe as well? Because obviously within the queer community, I mean, that's, you know, Eurovision Song for Europe. It's what I grew up on. It's like one of those things I look forward to it every year. And I kind of miss the Song for Europe days. I mean, I miss the days when it's like you could sort of like vote for your favourite act. You did it twice, 76 and then again in 84. Robbed both times, in my humble opinion, but there you go. I mean, were you aware of the magnitude of Eurovision? And was it something that you were very into growing up as well?
Oh, yeah. I watched it right from the early days. The one I remember watching from was Sandy Shaw and Puppet on a String. That's the one I remember from a childhood. I always remember I'd been to the fair and I came home and my family were watching. Everybody watched Eurovision and they were watching. And that was the first night I really paid attention. And it was Sandy Shaw. I loved Sandy Shaw. So, you know, it got my full attention. And from there on in, I've always loved Eurovision, really. And I loved being part of it, you know, actually taking part. And I mean, yeah, you know, it would have been great if I had have won it.
Did you enjoy Song for Europe? Was it a pleasurable experience?
I did, yeah, I did. I did enjoy it. But when I did it the second time, I'd already had a single out, which was Searching, on Proto Records as a club record. And I worked so hard on that record all around all the gay clubs all over the world, here in the UK. I really wanted to work hard because I knew that song was special. But Searching had been released, but of course we didn't get on the Radio 1 playlist. Barry Evangelis at the time at Proto Records, he deleted Searching, which was quite clever, because and we got the Song for Europe. So we decided if I didn't get Song for Europe, we would re-release Searching because there was a huge demand on it. Didn't win Song for Europe. And I think after that, I felt that I've done it now. I don't want to do Song for Europe anymore, that this would be the last one. But, of course, Searching became a huge hit. The rest is history, as they say.
Well, this is the thing, is it? I mean, it is. I mean, it's certainly the history of my queer life. I mean, if somebody said to me, name three records that literally have shaped my queer existence, Searching would be in that top three straight away. I mean, originally released in 1983, in the summer of 1983, and it reached, number 76, which is an absolute crime. But, you know, everything happens for a reason. So when it was re-released in June 84 and then went top 10, by that point, I mean, I remember seeing you for the first time and just thinking, oh my gosh, here is a pop star that represents my community, that represents the music that I love to listen to. And obviously it came through the gay clubs. So what was your first sort of experience of gay clubs, of sexuality around you and within you? What were your sort of feelings at that point? I mean, how did you discover the gay world, as it were?
Well, really, it was from Searching was number one in the gay club chart before I even stepped on a stage. I mean, when I say so, I mean a gay club. And so my first experience was Heaven, and it was packed, and they were going crazy for me even before I stepped on the stage. So as soon as they heard, as soon as they heard the start of Searching, it was all over. I just walked on, and I thought, oh my God, I've sort of come home, if you like. I mean, it was fantastic, and I've had this great relationship, you know, throughout my whole career, and so that was my first sort of experience, really.
So you said that, you know, you felt, oh, I've come home. I mean, going into that club and obviously being surrounded by, you know, members of the queer community, which we are part of, did it feel for you literally like, this is my tribe, this is where I'm supposed to be? I mean, were you resolute in your own sort of queerness at that point?
I'm not sure if I was doing that, but, you know, I knew this was my tribe. I mean, I knew I was gay at that point, obviously. But, yeah, it was just, I felt fantastic. You know, prior to me doing Heaven that night, I'd been singing in a band in London, a band, the Johnny Howard Band. You know, it's like a dinner and dance type thing. And so it was weird going from that, you know, over to Heaven, where I'd change out of my lovely evening gown and put on my outfit. And so, yeah, I mean, it was fantastic. And so from there on in, that was it. I was just doing what I wanted to do, which was, I still sang in bands and things. I stopped singing with bands New Year's Eve 1983 because I knew I'd got to get out there and work the song more. So that's when I stopped actually officially singing with live bands of that nature, you know, the big band type of thing, which was, yeah, I felt quite sad because I'd got so many friends and I loved it. I have great memories from those times, but that's when I knew that I had to change course.
Were you open to friends and loved ones at that point, Hazel? I mean, it's funny when you mentioned about obviously being on stage in Heaven and doing the Searching thing and doing the sort of, you know, the high energy and then going off and performing with the house band or whatever it may be. It's almost like having two like kind of lives there, but that wasn't replicated in your everyday life, your personal life.
Well, to be honest with you, I mean, I was the same wherever I was, whether I was in a dance band or I've known these people for years and I still have great friends from that period of my time, and they love me, Hazel. Didn't matter whether I was straight or gay. I was just, I mean, I did have, I had boyfriends up until I was about late 20s, to be honest. I lived with Paul for a couple of years. And so I did have boyfriends. I love strong women anyway. you know, whether they be gay or straight, but I was always drawn to that kind of thing. So it wasn't so much the whole gay thing, it was just all these people loving this song, and it happened to be a gay audience, and so yeah, I found what I wanted, really. I wanted people to go crazy for me when I'm on stage. I'm sure it's what every artist wants. So
Did the fame that came with that, did that come easy to you as well? I mean, lots of people dream of singing, but not necessarily want to be famous because, you know, I know these days we live in a day and age of social media where you can't sneeze without somebody putting it online. But back in those days, it was a lot easier to sort of live your true life and still be a pop star that we see on the telly and in smash hits and want to put posters of on our wall. Did you enjoy the fame that came with the success of Searching?
Yeah, I did. It's what I wanted. I wanted that, you know. I know that sort of. I think also with me, I wasn't, when I had the fame, I was 30. You know, when Searching became here, I was actually in my, so I wasn't a young sort of not knowing what was going on girl. I mean, I knew the scores on the doors, and so I knew that there would be things that would go with it. But I that's what I always wanted. So nothing was going to sort of stop me having that.
I mean, obviously you said you were dating guys as well. I mean, I did that too. I mean, obviously I dated guys, but it's like I dated girls because I needed to find out exactly what I wanted. It was, you know, for me, it was a case of like, well, if I didn't like something, I would not do it again. When did you reach that stage where you were kind of resolute and thinking, no, actually, I know 100% what I am now?
Well, I had a, back in the sort of mid-70s, funny enough, when I did the song for Europe, there was a manager in the audience called Victor Billings, who used to manage Dusty Springfield and Kiki Dee and a few other artists, and he loved my voice. And he got in contact with us, and Victor became my manager, and he was as camp as they come. And I had such a great time with him. You know, we went on the road, we did a tour with the New Seekers, I remember, in 1976, and it was just, but it was me as Hazel Dean, not in a band, it was Hazel Dean. I had my own band, but it was Hazel Dean, and he taught me lots of things. But I had such a great time with him, and of course, through him, I met gay women, and that's kind of, from there on in, it kind of, and I'm saying, now what years would that be, sort of 76, 77, sort of going into the late 70s.
Well, no, but I think we all have to develop at our own rate, don't we? We all, you know, follow our own path. And I think for me, it's like one of the things that I have always tried to do in my life is surround myself with people that just get me, the people that give me the same energy that I need. And it sounds like Victor was one of those people for you.
Absolutely. Oh, he was just fantastic. Yeah, I mean, I learned so much from him. I really, really did. You know, he just took me from that singer in a band onto the next stage, which has been a solo singer. And he had it all. I mean, you know, hand movements, all that kind of stuff. He was fantastic for me.
Hi there, Nigel here. Before we get back to the conversation, let's have a sneaky peek at some of the fabulous guests coming your way this season on A Gay Old Time. Jackie Cox, welcome to A Gay Old Time.
Hi, Nigel. How are you? I don't think I don't think I really got comfortable with like my sexuality until I started working at Disneyland when I was 19. And that is a very gay place to work. That locker room has some stories over there behind It's a Small World.
Coco, welcome to A Gay Old Time.
Also known as Clinton this morning. And the realization that I could sort of embrace being femme and my Bronx accent, it all just sort of came together, and I said, I'm going to be a drag queen.
With Searching, I mean, obviously, you know, massive hit. I mean, it's still iconic to this day, 40 years on, which is incredible. There was no follow-up. There was like nothing was planned. So there you were, suddenly this massive, great big pop star, you know, on top of the pops, doing your fabulousness, you know, singing this beautiful song that for our community, the queer community, had become an anthem. There must have been a pressure to suddenly think, hang on, what am I going to do for single two here?
Yeah, I was on a little independent label. So, but Pete Waterman, who I'd had done a couple of things, in fact, the song for Europe that I did in 1984, he put me together with the producer because that's what his company used to do, putting people together. Peter was always good at that and is still to this day, I'm sure. So, yeah, one time I was at Proto Records, and obviously I was sitting at number 6 in the charts with Searching. And I knew that I needed a follow-up. Ian Anthony Stevens, I mean, we recorded that in 1983. He was obviously doing other stuff. And I'm thinking, I need a follow-up. I was getting a bit desperate because I did not want to be a one-hit wonder. And just by chance, Pete Waterman happened to be at Proto Records that day. And he'd got this thing. He'd met Mike and Matt, and they were doing a thing with it was called Agents Aren't Aeroplanes. I don't know if you remember that.
I do. I do indeed.
Well, it's through that. He was there, obviously, chatting to Barry about blah, 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 whatever. And we bumped into each other. So obviously I said, hi, Pete, blah, blah, blah. And he was saying, well, what are you doing then? I said, well, right at this moment in time, Peter, I'm looking for a follow-up for Searching because I haven't got one. So he said, you come down to the studio. He said, I've got these two guys that I'm working with now, Mike and Matt. He said, Mark Eastwood, come down and listen to what we're doing. So off I trot to the Marquee studio and 2 or 3 days later. And I walk in and the backing track that I hear is Divine, You Think You're a Man. And I'm listening to it and it sounded, the track was so fantastic. You know, and I just said, yep, I want some of that. That's what I want. That's fantastic. So he says, right, we'll send you a song and see what you think. So because we had to work quickly. Again, a day or so went by and I received probably a cassette back in those days of, at the time it wasn't called Whatever I Do. It was called Dance Your Love Away. And I heard the song and what it was the verses of Whatever I Do that we hear, but it was a different chorus. And it just, the chorus just kind of just didn't go anywhere for me because Searching was such one of those big anthem choruses and I needed something that had that appeal to it. So I said, well, I love the verses. They're fantastic. And I like the story of the song, but the chorus just doesn't do it for me. So off they trot and they come up a couple of days. They've been, you know, do a bit more writing. That when it came back, it was the chorus that we hear. Whatever I Do, Wherever I Go. We recorded it so quickly. We had to because we needed that follow-up. But luckily in those days, being on a small label, you could turn stuff over a lot quicker than if you were on a major. So that's what we did. And so they had their first top 5 with me, which was Whatever I Do, Wherever I Go, in the summer of 1984.
I mean, this is the thing, isn't it? I mean, we live in an era where Stock, Aitken and Waterman and that whole era of music has finally gone full circle and become cool, which I love, because people kind of poo-pooed it wrongly for so long.
Well, it's a bit like ABBA, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Exactly the same. You were there at the beginning, Hazel. I mean, you mentioned about Divine there. I mean, first off, when you look back at the whole Stock, Aitken and Waterman period, there must be a huge fondness for you. And also, I've got to ask you, did you meet Divine? And if so, what was he like?
Oh, yeah. Divine was lovely. I was actually, Divine's manager, Bernard Jay, looked after me in America because I was on Capitol Records in America. So he always looked after me. And from 83 to probably 1991, I was over in America every year for about a month or so and doing all the clubs and you know, doing all my shows and things. So I had a fantastic time in America. So he used to look after me. So I got to know Divine quite well. And I think he was a bit wary of me at first, but I don't think he wanted anyone else in on his scene, as it were. Now, once he got to know me, you know, he was lovely. I got invited to his lovely apartment in panoramic views of New York and all that kind of stuff. We had afternoon tea. And so I got on great with him in the end. Did you ever see him on stage?
No, sadly, I didn't. I never met Divine. One of the few people from that era, because I worked as a journalist at that time, and like, I never got to actually interview Divine. I was working for a lot of pop magazines, and I think, you know, I was doing yourself and Sonia and Sunita and Kylie and Jason, but I didn't sadly get to interview Divine, which would have been literally divine, but such a loss to the world as well. But I mean, his legacy lives on for forever. Obviously,
oh, yeah.
That period in history as well, I mean, especially for our community, you know, the 1980s, we look back on it. I mean, for music and for my own personal progression, I think for people of my age, mid-50s, it was such a beautiful time in so many ways because it was a freeing time. But there was that huge, horrible spectre of AIDS that came along as well. What are your memories of that time? Because obviously you were in the clubs, I'm assuming, at the start of that period, Hazel.
I was, yeah. But I hadn't heard about AIDS. I didn't hear anything about it in the clubs. But I always remember, and it was in Brighton, and it was just starting to, things going in the paper and all that kind of stuff. And I always remember a club in Brighton. And I always remember at the club, you would walk down, you'd hear the thumping music as you walked in, and you'd walk down the staircase to the actual room. This particular night, I remember going, oh, great, you know, you hear the music and walking down the staircase. And I just, usually I'd walk into heaving crowds and things, but this night, empty, absolutely empty. Two or three people standing around. And the first thought, oh, my God, where is everybody? Maybe they don't want to see me anywhere. You know, there's all these crazy thoughts. But it wasn't. It was AIDS.
That's so horrible.
Yeah, it was horrible. And that was my first. A few more people did turn up, but, you know, compared to what it would normally be, it was very sad. So that was my first sort of experience of that whole sort of AIDS situation. And then after that, I mean, well, I got involved with various, I did lots of charities and just did, well, I carried on singing in the clubs. You know, I just got a bit of education. Obviously, that was, you know, about it and what to do and what not to do. And I carried on because a lot of people didn't, but I did. And so those were my experiences, my early experiences.
It was such, I mean, you know, a tragic time for our community in general. But I mean, as I said, the music of that time, I think, will always be some of the most joyous music ever. Your success beyond the first two singles, you know, continued to grow and grow and grow. I know there were a few songs that should have been a big, much bigger success than they were, in my opinion. Can I ask you about your styling as a pop star as well? I mean, I imagine, you know, back in the day, you know, because you were then part of a bigger record label and, you know, you were chart success, so people do try and style you a certain way. Were you ever made to wear things that you didn't want to wear, or was the styling, or did it always come from you? Because it seemed to me, looking on as a fan, that you were, you know, living your true life and being your true self.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't wear anything if I didn't like it. In the early days, I mean, as I say, we were on a bit of a small budget, being on a small label before Search became a hit and everything. And, I mean, I think I might have made a few mistakes then, but, you know, hey. As time went on, obviously I got better, but I wouldn't wear anything if I didn't really, really like it. Most of the things I wore, I liked. And, yes, when I was with PWL, of course, there were stylists. And but like I say, if I didn't like something, I wouldn't wear it.
So everything came from you then. There was never that pressure to be, you know, sexualized in a certain way and, like, oh, you need to wear tighter this or, you know, bigger hair that or whatever.
Not so much about my hair, because my hair was very big at times. PWL at some point did get this management team in, which they shouldn't have done, really, because there was a conflict of interest, really. But they got this guy in. He wanted me to do all these, you know, wear these little dresses and skirts up to my tops of my legs, shall we say. And I just said, no, that's not going to happen. That's the only time I've had that happen.
So I was to say, was there fight back from that particular person to say, well, actually, that's what we want you to wear? Or was it like, oh, no, Hazel said she's not wearing it?
The only thing someone said to me once a long time ago, he was a guitar player when I was still singing in bands, and the only thing he said to me was, Hazel, you need a different hairstyle. So, but that's the only thing I ever took on board.
So that's wonderful, though, because it's like you were resolute in your own image. Well, it sounds to me, I mean, that you've always been very confident, both within yourself personally and professionally as well, knowing exactly what you want. I mean, obviously, I mean, I think one of the things that many of us within the queer community, there's always a pivotal moment of like coming out and how our family react and all of that. It sounds, I mean, it seems that you've always had like a very good reaction to the fabulous gay individual that you are.
Yeah. Although, I mean, honestly with you, I didn't actually tell my parents until I was in my sort of mid-30s. But they knew. And I told my mum because I was going through a very difficult patch. And I said to her, I told her, and she said, oh, Hazel, his dad and I have known for the last 10 years that you were gay. And that was it. And I said, well, why didn't you say anything to me? So obviously they said, because we were waiting for you to tell us. I'm sure that's what happens, you know, with most people. So, and that was it. I've been so lucky, really, because I never had any problems with my family or friends. So It's all good.
That's brilliant, and that's how it should be. I mean, an ideal world.
Yeah, it should be, yeah.
Absolutely. Obviously, with, you know, the fact that you are this fabulous gay lady as well, I mean, you have become not just an icon for your singing, you have also become such an ally, such an advocate, such a supporter, such a visible persona for so many rights within our community. I mean, I know you're on the Pride Power List top 100 countless times for being one of the most influential people within our LGBTQIA plus community. How does that make you feel? I mean, is it something that you've always wanted to champion, or is it, do you find it strange being a role model? What are your thoughts on that, Hazel?
Sometimes I do find it a bit strange, but I could be more like it. I mean, obviously when the AIDS thing was going on, I did what I thought I should do. When I retired back in 2021, you know, I had more time to, although I had become a patron of Pride in Surrey, and I still am patron of Pride in Surrey, but then we had lockdown, and I became patron in fact, it was the beginning of March in 2020, and then it all sort of went bear-shaped. Although through the pandemic, I have to say they were fantastic. They went on the road with it, and they were fantastic, and they're lovely people, and they work really hard. But I had more time to do what I'm doing now, and I have to say Becky, who you saw earlier, my partner, I mean, she's an ally as well, and she helps me an awful lot because I am dyslexic, as I said earlier. So she helps me with, she does the Facebook for me and all that kind of stuff. And so she's a huge ally as well. So together, we call ourselves Team Deem. So together, this is what we do. You know, I just do the best I can, really, because, you know, I support because I care. Everybody who has a right to be what they want to be.
Could not agree more. And big up Team Dean. I am loving that. You mentioned your partner there. I mean, you've been civil partnered since 2005.
Yeah.
That's correct, if I remember rightly.
Yeah.
So nearly two decades. Without the, you know, giving me any personal details, how did you meet and how did you know that she was the one?
I've known Becky since she was about 16. She was a big Hazel Dean fan, but we got together a lot later on. We met up in the 90s, I think, and I'd done a show, and we just sort of started talking and kind of went from there, really. We met up for dinner in London, and the rest is history, as they say.
No, but that's the way it should be. I mean, I love that. That doesn't always have to be a drama or an intrigue. Sometimes it can just be, do you know what? I knew this person and we became more than friends, and that was the right thing to do, which is perfect. So you met sort of like early 90s, 91, 92,
yeah,
whenever it was, and then civil partnered in 2005. Now, obviously, you have a daughter as well, which is joyous.
We do, yeah.
I mean, that's another thing. I mean, you appear to be a champion for so many things. I mean, same-sex parenting is such a joyous thing these days, because it seems it's not the sort of forbidden fruit that it once seemed to be.
No, it's fantastic. I mean, Stevie is just, it's one of the best things I've ever done, to be honest. It's, it really grounds you. And suddenly, I mean, I joke to people because they say to me when Stevie was born and before, I said, well, I was too busy being a star. When Stevie was born, that was the end of that, you know, because Stevie was and still is the star of our show. It changes your whole life, I tell you. It really does. But it's good. I think it's good, and I think it's been really good for me.
Would you like Stevie to follow in your footsteps?
Stevie won't. She goes to uni now because she's 19, and Stevie wants to work with animals. She's doing as zoology at Reading University, so that's the path she wants to follow. She did. I mean, she came on stage with me loads of times. She loved it, but, you know, it's not for Stevie.
You mentioned just now, I mean, you're such a champion as well for trans rights. I mean, you must have seen, you know, as we all have, of people of a certain age, our community change so much over the years. What do you feel about the state of our community at the moment? I mean, not just trans, but beyond that as well, for the entire community.
I think I mean, obviously, we've moved forward a hell of a lot with things. I mean, obviously, we have, but there's so much kind of unrest, isn't there, at the moment in the country? And I think everyone's a little bit nervous. I think, you know, personally, I think the whole world's gone mad. So I tend to, you know, I just, that's how I feel. I think there is unrest. I think people are worried about what's going to happen. You know, I just get on with my life, really, and just do the best I can. I can't do any more than that, but I just, if I can help people, put things on my Facebook and do the right thing, and I will, you know, I will stand up and say, you know, and I just want to have a nice life as well. So I try and sort of keep calm about the whole thing. But there is definitely big problems.
It feels to me, Hazel, that, I mean, it's wonderful that you are able to use your voice because of who you are and because obviously people know you. But everything that you put out there seems to be genuinely from the heart as well. It's a case of, like you say, you still want to live your life, but you are aware of other people's lives as well. I mean, it seems to me that you are a very caring individual. Has that always been the case?
I think so, yeah. I care for people. I mean, obviously, I've been in a business that's hard, and I've had to push through, and maybe I've been a bit naughty here and there, but trying to make my way through the music industry. But you know, that's part of it. It's tough, and if you don't do those things, you just, you know. I mean, as I said before, I've always had a tunnel vision, and I know what I have to do, and you've got to fight through. But when it comes to people's feelings, you know, that's a different ball game. You know, then I care about situations. I think I'm a truthful person, and I like to tell the truth, and I'd say things like it is, and I think I do the right things.
Have you ever had any rock and roll moments? Have you ever done that, you know, not the throwing the telly out of the hotel window, but has there ever been, I don't know, back in the days on the Stock Aitken and Waterman tours and the road shows and things like that, did you ever have a rock and roll moment?
The only time I ever, and not on the PWL things because it was always good, but the only time I would get upset was if this, and this is just a typical sort of singer's thing, is if the sound was crap, pardon my expression, in the club. In the end, I back in the day, I would take my own sound engineer with me because I can't bear awful sound. You know, I want to be able to hear what I'm doing, and I want everybody else to be able to hear it. So they were the only times I would do a diva moment. If I had to, I could pull it out of the bag.
Did you have a rider when you were off on tour?
I remember. Yeah, oh yeah, I had a rider. Yeah, but my rider was so easy. I mean, all I wanted was like maybe some nice cup of tea and water, a lockable dressing room with a mirror. I can't see that. I mean, I have seen some riders of other people in my time, and it's stupid things.
Any that you can mention?
No. But I have, you know, and I think, why? You know, as long as you, and most times people would put some, you know, bit of food here and there and stuff like that. As long as you've got a sort of fairly reasonable dressing room, and some places, some of the clubs I worked, they couldn't because they were just funny little places. But as long as I had a mirror and there was a toilet nearby and whatever, oh, for goodness sake, you know, just get on with it, really.
Easy to please, and that's what we like. Hazel, one of the things I think, and again, in our queer community, it's like we get to an age where we feel comfortable in our own skin. I mean, you mentioned earlier that you didn't come out to your mum until, you know, in your 30s, and at that point she was like, yeah, we've known for years, dear, which I think is the perfect answer. It seems to me throughout this chat that you've always been comfortable in your own skin. Is that fair to say?
Oh, definitely, yeah. I'm happy to be me. I might have a moan about, I always wish I'd been taller, but those stupid things, you know. But I've always been comfortable in my own skin, always.
Which I think is lovely, because, I mean, not everybody can say that.
No, I know.
Are you glad that you were a pop star, you know, having your success when you did? I mean, I know we mentioned the 80s was not the best period in many ways, but for music and the enjoyment, it seemed to be so much fun. How do you think Hazel Dean would cope with being a pop star in, you know, in the 2020s?
Oh, no, too old. I couldn't keep up with the pace. I couldn't. I mean, when I think about my life back then, I thought, oh God, just thinking about it makes me feel tired, to be honest with you. But no, I loved all that time. I loved the music in the 60s, 70s and the 80s. And no, I wouldn't change a thing.
Let's have some fun to end the podcast. I always like to do this. Hazel, because you've been such a fabulous guest, your reward is to throw the perfect dinner party for yourself. You can have five fabulous guests. They can be LGBTQ or otherwise. They can be alive or dead. Make them famous so we know who you're talking about. That always helps. Who would be your five guests and why?
First of all, it would be my mum and dad. Both my mum and dad have passed away because I love them and I miss them. So I'd like mum and dad to be there. Miss Streisand.
Oh, wow.
Barbara Streisand. Have you read her new book, by the way?
No, I haven't. I think I need to. I need to get it on audio because it's about 48 hours long, but I could just do that in long car journeys.
Oh, God, the book is huge. I've just finished it.
So why Barbara then? Why would you like Barbara?
Because I love Barbara Streisand. You know, I just think she's very interesting. She's very bright.
Here's a question then. Are you aware, did she ever get to hear Evergreen?
I don't know. Oh. I have no idea.
Because your version of that is superb.
I have no idea. I mean, I've never had any sort of connection with her. In fact, if I met her, I'd be speechless, which is usually difficult for me. But yeah, I just think she's a legend. I love Barbara Streisand. You've got to read the book. It's fantastic. I would have Diana Ross, and I'd have them both because also they are legends. And then, oh yeah, there's one more. We did write something down. It'd either go to Cher, RuPaul or Ozzy Osbourne.
Wow, that's a different trio.
Yeah. Stevie and Becky would have to fight this out. We've written this down. But I suspect Cher would win because everybody loves Cher.
Too right. I'm loving that. So that would be, quite frankly, I think the campus dinner party that anybody could ever go to. Hazel Dean, Cher, Diana Ross, Barbara Streisand, your late mother and father, that would be a dinner party and a half. What would you serve up? If you had Diana Ross and Barbara Streisand coming round, what would you serve? Are you good in the kitchen, Hazel?
Yeah, I'm not bad. I'd probably get Becky to cook something for us.
What's her speciality?
Oh, she does lots of Asian food and it's nice. And I'm more your basics. Like for last night, I made a very nice chicken casserole. I'm good at that and, you know, all those sort of English dishes. But I'm not a bad cook. I used to cook a lot more, but I think as I've gotten older, I've kind of not, I thought, I'm fed up of doing this.
I'm sure Diana Ross would love chicken casserole. It's got to be done.
Oh, I'm sure she would.
You mentioned, you know, earlier on about your first time in an LGBTQ safe space when you were performing Searching. What's the best experience you've had in a gay nightclub or a gay safe space?
Oh, that is impossible for me to say. Every gay club I've ever done has been a safe place everywhere, all over the world. I always feel safe. And we always used to say, you know, when you arrive at the club, especially back in those days, because you'd always have the drag queen, two drag queens. And I always used to think when I got into the club or wherever and the drag queens, I felt safe because they always looked after me. But gay clubs, I always felt safe in all of them.
I mean, you mentioned drag there as well. But what were your first experiences of drag? I mean, do you remember the drag queens from that time? Who were the ones that did take, you know, young pop star Hazel under their wing?
Paula Grady, of course. Oh, God, I'm trying to think of the names. Regina
Thong, yes.
Regina Thong, yeah.
Adrella from that time as well. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, they're the two that come to mind straight away.
Hazel, obviously, you know, myself and, you know, millions of other people around the world rush to the dance floor for your tracks to go and dance to Searching. Oh, it's so true. Whatever I do, wherever I go. I mean, all of them are absolute corkers. What makes you dance? If you're in a club and a song comes on to get you onto the dance floor, what would that song be?
Well, probably one of the earliest memories would be, well, I used to like all the old soul stuff and I used to like reggae. I used to like that. But the one, moving forward a bit, the one that probably would always get me going is Never Can Say Goodbye, Gloria Gaynor. It is one of my all-time favourite records. I used to play it to death. I used to drive my poor old mum and dad mad with that, because on her album of that period of time, there was probably one of the earliest sort of long versions, like a 12-inch version, but it was on the album. I used to play it all the time. I used to drive them crazy with it, but I loved it. Great strings. It had everything.
It's a great tune. Can I mention ABBA as well? Because obviously, I mean, I know you have covered so many ABBA songs. And I'll be honest, I was one of those Puritans that was said that people can't cover ABBA. Nobody does ABBA as well as ABBA. I will say on this podcast right now, for anybody that wants to hear it, you and Cher are the two people that I think can cover ABBA incredibly well.
She made Fernanda her own, didn't she? When she said it, sang it. Yeah, she definitely did. It was great. But of course I love ABBA. When I used to sing in bands, I used to sing loads of ABBA songs, say Dancing Queen or all the big ones. But no, I thoroughly enjoyed doing the ABBA tracks. It's just, being careful how you do them, really, and treat them with respect. Not stray. I wouldn't stray. Some people sort of take them to extremes, and then they don't work anymore, you know. And I just think very carefully about how I'm going to record them. And so my last thing that I did, the remixes of the last album on SP Music, which was Eight. It was called Eight. Did you get that? Have you heard that?
I did indeed. Of course I did.
Did you like my version of Winner Takes It All?
Yeah, I remember that. I mean, I think the last time I interviewed you was when you released the Winner Takes It All back in, whenever it was, first time round.
Back in the 90s, yeah.
Yeah, back in those days. And I loved it then. But I've got to say, I mean, I've loved luck with your remixes and also your choice of ABBA songs. You have recorded some ABBA songs that I think other people just overlook, you know, Slipping Through My Fingers and things like that. I mean, just brilliant songs. So am I right in thinking ABBA would always get you to the dance floor?
Yeah, they would. I love ABBA. But it's just, you know, it's always very easy to cover the obvious songs. And so I wanted to pick some. I mean, obviously, The Winner Takes It All is, for me, is one of the best pop songs ever written. I think that's just a sensational song. And I always wanted to do it with a big string thing. And the other one that I was really pleased with was For Remembering Things These Days.
Sing me a bit and I might recognise it, Hazel.
One of us is lonely.
One of us.
One of us is, yeah. I wanted to do One of Us, but I wanted to take it away from that reggae feel. And so we gave it more of a soul-to-soul feel on the Eight album, and I absolutely love it, you know. I don't listen to my own things that often, but when I do, and when I play that one, I think, I love this feel on this track. It works so well, and I was so pleased when it did. It's just thinking about the things really carefully. Because when I go in the studio, I always go in with lots of ideas of how, where I want to do, what I want to do with it. And I thought that one worked out really nicely. It's just being choosy about, you know, not just slapping it out as another ABBA song and you know, fodder, what I call fodder. I like to choose, you know, special songs. And there's such a great catalogue. There's such some lovely songs that no one ever bothered to cover because they would always cover Dancing Queen. There are other fantastic songs. It's just doing your research and stuff, really.
It's so true. You're obviously proud of every song, it seems, that you've put out there. But what's your proudest rainbow-flavoured moment of your life? I mean, there are so many, I imagine, to choose from. But when you look back and you think, yeah, that moment was particularly good, maybe for our community or for your own feeling of confidence with your own sexuality, is there one moment?
Well, there are three. Obviously, the first one was the first night at Heaven, I would say. The second one was a Pride that I did a march, because when I used to go to Pride, obviously I'd turn up and just get on and a lot of them would sing. But this particular one was at Western Supermere, and I went up the night before and I went on the march, you know, through the town. I cried. It was so big and so emotional, and it was fantastic. And then the last one was I did London Pride in 2022 with a group, Cheer Up. But did you know the Cheer Up people?
Of course, Mario. Yes, I do.
Mario, lovely Mario. And I went on the parade with them, and I'm not kidding, there was over a million people. It's the biggest London Pride ever up until that point. And it was unbelievable. I mean, it was, again, you know, tears in my eyes, and it was the noise. I've never heard anything like it. The cheering. And the noise. And when we sort of got to the other end, I had such a headache. It was so loud, but it was fantastic. And that was another time. And it was just, you're so uplifting. It's fantastic.
I mean, prides are always so uplifting, aren't they? You have uplifted so many people with your music. But obviously, you mentioned earlier, 2021, you retired after 38 years of performing. I know, obviously, at the moment, we're celebrating 40 years of Searching with lots of fabulous new remixes as well. And, you know, you're doing question and answers and sort of events and things like that. You have been quite public in saying you don't miss performing. Did you know that the time was right to sort of say, no, enough is enough. I just want to be a family, be with my lovely partner, be with my daughter? Was that the reason behind the decision?
It's funny enough, going back to Lulu, she was on the One show last night, and she, because this is her last tour, Champagne for Lulu, so I've got to go and see her. And she said, you know, when you're out, when you're touring, I mean, obviously for her, she takes a big band, and she said, it's so tiring. Or she said, but being on stage is the magic moment. But she said the rest, everything around it is so hard and so tiring. And that's kind of how I felt. I was fed up with traffic, how long it would take you to get somewhere. And I'm a person that likes to arrive on time and all that kind of stuff. And I'd get so stressed. And then sometimes, you know, it's going in and out of hotels and all the sort of, all this, it's just all the stress around it, really. So often I'd get on stage, I'd be so tired with the stress that I had had enough. And I would get very tired, and sometimes it would affect my voice. Not so much my high range and low range, it was always the middle, my middle voice. And it used to worry me. I'm still going in, I'm still working in the studio, which is great, and doing stuff and fantastic. I'm doing sort of a bit of writing, and I'm just doing what I do, and I can do it at my own pace. I don't have to sort of, I'm not on any deadline now. So,
well, absolutely. I mean, you deserve some time to yourself as well, you know, for holidays or whatever. Hazel, can I say thank you for joining me today on the podcast? It's been an absolute pleasure. I can't believe it's 40 years since Searching, but you have produced brilliant records for 40 years, and I hope for many years to come. Aww. Thank you for chatting today and for proving to us all that Hazel Dean, indeed your life has been a gay old time.
It certainly has.
That's it for this episode of A Gay Old Time. I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Hazel as much as I did. She's a true icon. Make sure you go and check out those remixes of Searching to celebrate 40 years of that fabulous song, and get yourself dancing to the rest of the back catalogue whilst you're at it. I want to see you shaking those hips after this podcast. If you'd like to experience more rainbow joy, then please subscribe and follow the podcast on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you're listening right now, maybe on the Gaydio app. And do go and follow the Instagram account as well, at A Gay Old Time Podcast. Thanks a million to Juliet at Pineapple Audio Production for making everything sound so peachy and wonderful. I'll be back soon with another episode featuring a deep and meaningful with an inspirational individual. Until then, from me, Nigel May, sending all the love and hoping that whatever you're up to, if it applies to you, that you're having a gay old time. Enjoy.